evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Lauren K. Alane. Alane is a poet who hails from the Twin Island Republic of Trinidad and Tobago. Her work has been published in many anthologies and literary journals, including the Bayan Review and Black Arts Quarterly. In 2003, she won the Atlantic Monthly Student Writing Prize. She's currently an assistant professor of English and creative writing at Hobart William Smith Colleges. Welcome to the show, Lauren.
Thank you, Tish.
Now, and as a native of Trinidad and Tobago, tell us a little bit about your upbringing and what was it that helped you to discover writing?
Oh, my goodness. What about Trinidad? We are warm country, climate, and I think personality. And in terms of writing, I feel as though creativity is a big part of our culture, home of the greatest show on earth, Carnival. My sister sings Calypso, and I wrote for her. This was in elementary and high school. Stories are a big part of what we do and of our culture. And so I feel as though definitely that upbringing has spurred me toward writing. I've always loved it.
Uh-huh.
So it's been something I've done.
And so were you encouraged as a child? Did they notice that you had this productivity to...
Yes, reading and writing, definitely. At every turn, I got books. I got out of housework if I was reading.
Really?
Which was, don't disturb her, she's reading. which was useful. But I also feel it's interesting as well, because it's so much a part of the culture. It's just also not something you do for a living. So that idea of taking it beyond just a good habit was not something I came to until, much, much later in college, actually.
Uh-huh. And did you start out writing poetry?
I would say I started out writing calypsos and stories more than poetry. I can't remember when I started writing poetry, actually. I think prose and songs were my first entry into writing.
Uh-huh. And do you remember the first thing you ever wrote?
Do I remember? No.
It wasn't a calypso for your sister?
I think the first thing I ever wrote and saw come to some kind of fruition was, probably a calypso for my sister, at which point we kind of simultaneously realized that, I could write and she could sing, which we didn't know, really. And, we did that for years.
Well, to explain to our listeners what calypso means.
Calypso is really an amazing phenomenon. It's something that at Carnival time, Calypsonians write, and it's every year you write a new calypso or several new calypsos, and they're social commentary. They are party songs. They are, charged with all kinds of cultural whatever is going on at the moment, whether it's home or abroad, and that's why they're new every single year. It's a very interestingly innovative but also very disposable art. I mean, there are some that carry that away back when, but again, the references get lost over time. Mm-hmm. So that you're always producing.
So it's like a form of storytelling.
It is in many ways, but it's also an old slave tradition where they would rib the masters and kind of, again, that idea. It's very transgressive. The politicians kind of steel themselves around Carnival time because everything they have done all year is under scrutiny and and is sang about in, very, very direct and scathing ways at some point. So, yeah, it's very, it's a great art form. And I definitely think that's, one of the first things I wrote was, about youth violence or youth issues, and I know it was something along those lines. I won't even try to render it for you.
Now, I know you came to the U.S. in 1997 for your college education. Tell us about your first impressions of the U.S.
When I came in 97, my college was a very small Catholic college in New York, and a lot of my friends who went to other places said I never really got to leave home, because that year they had taken the biggest cohort of international students, and a lot of them from the Caribbean. So it was a very measured introduction to the U.S. in the sense of we had a very active, thriving community in the college which is where we spent all our time. But on the other hand, you know, I loved New York. It was so much bigger than everything I had ever experienced up to that point. The weather was interesting. Again, kind of remembering that you put clothes on to go outside, like that many, was something I didn't think of often. And it's the bigness of it, I think, is the first thing that I remember feeling like, oh my goodness, it's huge.
It is indeed, even to some of us
right?
Been there often. Now, I want to ask you to read a new poem, if you will. And,
sure.
And the one that I would like to hear is called How It Touches Us. And tell us a bit about it.
This is based on a true story, actually. I wrote this poem very recently, but when I was 13 and in high school, this was written a friend of ours in my class, actually. A classmate had diabetes, and she went into a diabetic coma and passed away. And it was a very traumatic experience, as you might imagine. And I've thought about it often, and I think she's the first person I knew who died. I mean, 13, you kind of know what that means and everything, but I think it has taken years to write about that experience, and especially, I think, you know, toward the end, what I remember of it. And I guess this was kind of, I was trying to figure out what about that experience I still hadn't been able to process.
Mm.
How It Touches Us, for Anjani Maharaj. Our teacher trembled at the board as she unraveled the snarl of events. Exhaustion, a nap, the sickening realization our friend was in a coma. We'd gawked at lunchtime around Anjani's desk, shuddered at her calm as she loaded up the insulin, flicked the needle and slipped it beneath her skin, its live blue tracks. I remember thinking I couldn't bear to live like that. But day after day, when her chair remained empty, I prayed she would come back to her body. Once, we'd worked together on a project about the universe and its parts, planets, stars, atmosphere, black holes. I couldn't remember which of us had kept it afterward. The whole class went to the funeral, young and somber in our crisp collars and dark overalls. We shuffled past the coffin. She lay white-faced and red-lipped as a doll. The pyre waited at the river, its rough frame wreathed like a wedding car with marigolds and loud red hibiscus. Our teacher said we didn't have to, but we followed her into the crowd gathered on the bank. The fire flung sparks like little stars. When the pundit lit the torch to the wood, her mother's wails rose, first a tired thread, then heavier in thick, tangled knots of grief. When her body moved, I was unafraid. I thought we would witness a miracle, that she'd get up and walk through those flames, grinning. But the motion was mechanical, her muscles stirring as the tendons and ligaments contracted, a reaction to the heat, that was all. No act of God, no resurrection. Instead, the bang, her skull shattering, no longer able to contain her brain as it expanded, the awful realization that all laws of matter must hold true, that she was gone.
And that's beautiful.
Thank you.
Now, is that a tradition?
Trinidad is an interesting cultural mix, and there's a large percentage of Hindus. And Anjani was a Hindu, and that's a common Hindu practice, the burning, the cremation, as a way of dealing with the death.
So that must have been traumatic for you.
It was the first time that I also witnessed a cremation.
Uh-huh.
So definitely. I did not know about the bang at the end. I was not prepared for that and kind of heard this noise. And that's when people kind of leave. You know, it's their moment of departure.
Hmm. Wow, what a powerful poem. And do you think being a writer gives you a sort of a different take on your experiences?
I think it helps me to process them. I didn't know what I was feeling or thinking. And, you know, all I know is I remembered that moment and I was kind of writing toward it. So I definitely feel as though, for me anyway, it's one way of kind of figuring out what I think or how I feel about things.
Uh-huh. Yeah, very powerful. Now, in 2003, while you were a grad student at Cornell, you won first prize in the Atlantic Monthly Writing Contest. Now, tell us about the poem that won. It was called X-Ray?
The X-Ray, indeed. The poetry prize was a great gift. The X-Ray was a poem about an X-Ray. I had, you know, I thought I had a fractured wrist, and I went to the doctor and she kind of put it up there and was pointing at various things, and I kind of was staring at it and thinking, This is so interesting, you know, the kind of internal made so clearly visible. And I think that was just the impetus for that poem. I enjoyed writing it. It was, I think, one of those gift poems that I wrote about very shortly after and kind of came very smoothly.
Uh-huh. Now, I heard that you originally came to the U.S. to become a medical student. Talk to us about that.
Yes, I have a science background. In high school, we have the British system in Trinidad, and so you kind of focus very early on. I did biochemistry and computer science and all the good science subjects in high school, and I had physics and math at A-levels, and I was going to do medical physics, radiologic science and all that good stuff. At least that was the plan, the vague notion when I came to the U.S. And it was a good practical career that I could take back home and have a livelihood with. And then I defected. I had a really wonderful professor of English, and I'd always pursued English. I mean, I did very well in my English at home, and I'd gotten the highest in the island in literature for my A-levels. But again, it wasn't really something I was going to ever do anything with besides enjoy. I got in my second year, I was going to transfer to SUNY Downstate to get the practical ends of the education. And then my friend and I both went, and you know, we sat there and we looked at the schedule of endocrinology, genetics, and the list, and I just thought, I can't do this.
Really?
And we both left. You know, she was going for occupational therapy, and you know, we both left. We were just like, we can't do this. And it was not easy to change, because I took a lot of resources from my family to get me here, and English is not exactly promising as a loan repayment major, but it was, I felt, the only thing I could do at that point, and uh-huh. So I did it.
Uh-huh. Now, we talked about Calypso. You were obviously interested in English literature. Were you exposed to it in Trinidad, or was it something you just found out about here?
No, absolutely. I mean, we do a lot of reading and writing in the curriculum, heavily British more than American, uh-huh. And very differently than the U.S. It was one of the things I struggled with becoming an English major here, in that, you know, at home for A-levels, we studied 9 books in 2 years. Like,
wow.
We read in class slowly and read all the criticism. You know, we spent a lot of time, and then kind of falling into a survey course with, like, so many. It was a very, very different experience of literature, but I also feel that that's partially responsible for my love of it.
Uh-huh. So when you came here, what were the major differences?
I think the big difference, I would say, between the systems in general is we focus so early, right? You know, we kind of narrow from, you take an exam to get into high school, and there are people who, if they don't get into that exam, don't go to high school. You kind of can fall out of the system really early, and it kind of requires that you specialize. You know, I was a science student. I did all science courses except for English literature and English language, which you had to take, and spent a lot of time with those few subjects. I didn't know that you could kind of just change your mind. You can't do that in a university in Trinidad. You wouldn't have the qualifications to kind of move from science to English, mm-hmm. because you would need all this other background that you would not have had. So it's kind of liberating, actually, but different.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lauren Elaine. She's a poet and an assistant professor of English at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Now, Lauren, I want to ask you to read another piece for us, and this one's called Portrait of Dame Van Winkle.
Yes.
Tell us a little about it, yeah.
The Dame Van Winkle series is something that I stumbled upon at Cornell, which has been haunting me ever since. I'm rewriting a series of poems in the voice of Rip Van Winkle's wife, the Dame Van Winkle. Mm. I guess the question that drove me to it initially was, what do you do while you're waiting for someone you love to hopefully come back? In my head, it was 100 years, and I went back to the story, and I realized it was only 20. But going back to the story, I realized as well that while I knew the notion of the story, the language of the story is very interesting. Rip is described as kind of this lazy vagabond guy, and there are some really terrible descriptions of his wife. She's a termagant, a shrew, you know. A man with a termagant wife has this huge struggle, and I was really taken aback, whereas in the story, the way that although Rip is this no good character, his wife is all the worse for yelling at him about it. And so, you know, one poem became more and more. And really, I think for a long, long time, Dame Van Winkle was sharing my apartment. And this is a portrait of Dame Van Winkle. I was not especially beautiful, eyes and angles too stubborn for a girl. Truth be told, I was a bit the wild one. The mountains called to my feet like a tune, and I danced every day. Oh, how I danced. Enter Rip. Carefree charm like a cheap wine, unrefined but heady, and over time I grew giddy. Together we spun dreams like fine cloth. The sound of our laughter seemed like forever, like possibility. Me, a plain woman with a streak of strange, him odd but easy company, marriage a bargain for us both, and almost bliss. Who could have foreseen it would come to this?
That's great.
Thank you.
Now, you know what I want to talk to you about? I want to talk to you about the fact that you recently returned from an experience as a writing center coordinator while at the Weill Medical College in Qatar. Tell us about that experience.
It was a really wonderful experience. Weill Cornell Medical College in Qatar is a satellite of the Cornell University in Ithaca and the Weill Cornell Medical College in New York, and it's part of a larger organization, Education City and the Qatar Foundation, which is the dream child of the emir and the emir's wife in Qatar. And basically, we have a pre-medical program, which is 2 years and very intensive, and allows the students to kind of train for medical school, the Weill Cornell Medical College. And the Writing Center was a new experiment that they started last fall, and it was wonderful. It was a really great experience. The kids were bright and really dedicated.
What were you actually doing?
Basically, it was a support system because English was not the first language of a number of our students. Oh. And, of course, in order for them to read chemistry and biology in English, they really needed that foundation. And as well, they were taking an English course. They had a requisite English course. And, yes, a lot of them just needed some help in terms of developing some critical thinking skills, developing their writing skills. Their system as well is one that's very different than the academic training that you kind of receive in America. And moving into the Cornell system was a little bit difficult for a lot of our students. So it was mostly a support role.
Oh.
And I enjoyed it a lot.
Oh, that's great. Now, you also taught creative writing and freshman writing at Cornell.
I did.
To tell us a little bit about that experience. Well, what do you recommend to aspiring writers?
Oh, you know, I just feel as though one of the joys of teaching intro to creative writing is, at least what happened for me was, you know, when you suddenly realize that you can transform something you like, a craft. And I really try to focus on crafting in, because it's something that I never had, I guess, in some ways, or not until much later, I should say. And so I feel as though the idea of how one comes to, how you take creativity and shape it, I feel is what I ask my creative writers to do. You know, I say we can all write, let's write something right now, and then let's talk about how we make it better and how we make it say what we want to say and how we look for the things it says that we didn't intend. And I just really enjoy it. I think, a wonderful process to, and even, you know, I don't expect people to be able to publish in The New Yorker after my class, but I expect that they will engage with their own creativity in a serious and committed way. And that's pretty much what I ask of my students.
Mm-hmm. And how does your creative process work?
I wish I knew. No. my creative process. I don't have an easy answer for that. I think I write a lot out of prompts because, again, the idea of holding on to creativity, I have ideas, but always getting them down isn't easy. And so I have, even in my purse right now, my little writing prompt book. I have a couple of them. And I think writing exercises often become serious things. The How It Touches Us began as a write about a childhood experience, and it was the first thing that came to mind, and I thought, how strange. And so I always feel as though, like, those kind of structured questions that I then try to answer in my work somehow, is how I get to my process. So I enjoy being in environments, hence the academia, that constantly asks me to question things, because then I'm able to work out some answers.
Uh-huh. And are you somebody who will, you know, be traveling or taking a bath or sipping a cup of coffee and suddenly lines will come to you?
I've had that happen. It's unfortunate when a pen isn't close by, because I also have a really terrible memory. But yes, I feel that happens. But I also feel, for me, it's less inspirational and more seeking.
Mm-hmm. And are you of the persuasion that says that one must write every day in order to stay in practice?
I believe it works. I wish I could do it better. Mm. I'm not in the hat. I can't do everything every single day. I'm bad at that. But I did have an experiment for a few months where I, you know, dragged myself to the computer first thing out of bed and stayed there until I had written something.
Until you couldn't stand it any longer.
So, you know, I was so hungry I would have to crawl away unless I wrote something. And, you know, I got some good material out of that. Again, I feel what's good about that is you may not get something every day, but you're thinking, you know, or you're open to the possibility of something happening. That's good. And, you know, I wrote 20 terrible poems and one that got published, which, you know, I don't know that I would have written that poem if I hadn't been writing a poem a day, number 28, you know? Uh-huh. So, uh-huh.
That's the creative process, though, because I know a lot of photographers, they take 100 shots and maybe there are two that are really great. Yeah. That's the same kind of process. Now, we have time for one more poem. I'd love it if you would read Fear and Trembling and tell us a bit about it.
Fear and Trembling is, again, I'm addicted to sonnets in a certain way, and I was writing a series. I'm Catholic, and I was thinking about Lent around Lent time, and also taking a class called Writing the Void, which focused on reading a lot of Kierkegaard and Simone Weil and these interesting people who are thinking about spirituality and religion and its social implications, and I was writing a series out of that, and this is one of the last ones I wrote in that series, Fear and Trembling. And there are many ways to come undone, some more exquisite than others. Ask Eve. She will tell you apple lust unwrapped her, left her cold and with a word for shiver. Lot's wife is witness that a backward glance is enough. Nostalgia pillowed her. But I imagine the somewhat greater deeds, the Red Sea unstitched like a turquoise braid, the lion's den, its many hungry mouths, Isaac's bewildered screams, why, Daddy, why? And what terrible choice to peel back doubt like a bandage, without question or lack to say, here am I, to renounce relief, step in, seize the knife, and to know belief.
How much does religion affect your writing in general?
My family is very religious, and I feel in some ways I am as well, but not in the ways that I used to be, and it's something that I always think about in a lot of ways, and so that I feel it's always an undercurrent, or again, it's something I'm thinking about, so therefore I write about it a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the ideas of a structured religion versus a spirituality. I grew up in the church and playing guitar for church and singing in the choir, and, you know, we were very, very Catholic. And even outside of that, though, I always my mom tells the story of her getting kicked out of a First Communion class because she wouldn't say the Pope was infallible. She was like, he's a man and man is fallible. And, you know, this was back before they revised that and kicked that part out. And so there's a way in which we were always very structured, but also very challenging in my family. And so that has not changed.
Well, that's part of creativity, though. Well, one does need to question.
You have to question.
Absolutely. Now, we only have a couple minutes left. You're embarking on an assistant professorship at Hobart William Smith Colleges. Tell us what you're going to be doing.
I am on a one-year appointment there, and I'm you know, I've loved it so far. It's been very exciting. It was a huge move. The provost keeps giving me the prize for the person who has come the longest distance, because I came from Qatar and I'd never seen the place. But I'm teaching creative writing and intro to lit and some more advanced creative writing and literature courses this year. And I'm really, you know, I'm happy with the students. I'm happy with the faculty and everything. So I'm really looking forward to it. Hopefully it'll be a good year.
Oh, that's great. Now, do you think you could be teaching creative writing? Do you think one could without having done it yourself?
Teach creative writing?
Yeah, without being a creative writer.
I wonder. Well, I feel as though without being a creative writer, I feel as though with my students, I spend a lot of time talking about my process because it's the only one I truly have any, and it's, I don't even have a handle on it, but it's the one I experience the most. However, can you teach any trade without having some knowledge or experience? I feel as though maybe a deep reader, although that's a very different skill. I'm not quite sure how I feel about that. I'd have to think that one over. I should maybe write a poem about it.
And then, what are you working on now? And anything that we can look forward to in the future?
I am trying to transform my MFA manuscript into my first book, and I've been tugging at it for a while and adding. The dame keeps, you know, coming up, and so I'm adding new things to it. I'm taking out some stuff. I'm working on things. So hopefully, I'm hoping that soon I will be able to have something published in full.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for sharing your stuff with us, and really appreciate.
Thank you for having me.
Great. Thank you, Lauren. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.